a Canadian journalist infiltrates an international network of violent extremists.
They don't care who they maim or hurt or kill.
White supremacists who want to spark a race war and incite the collapse of society.
Embrace the chaos, and from its ashes, a new world shall arise. To victory, white man!
I'm Michelle Shepherd, and I'll take you inside this movement to learn where it came from and where it's headed next. White Hot Hate, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Duncan McHugh, sitting in for Matt Galloway, and this is a podcast from the March 7th edition of The Current.
Calvin, when I came to you with those calculations, we thought we might start a chain reaction that would destroy the entire world.
I remember it well. What of it?
I believe we did.
From one of this year's biggest movie hits, that's Cillian Murphy as J. Robert Oppenheimer. The film is a front runner at this Sunday's 96th Academy Awards. The Oscars have gone through many changes, especially after recent criticism that they weren't recognizing diverse filmmakers and actors. However, one thing that has remained constant is the Academy's love for films based on historical events and characters or stories set in the past. Kim Nelson is an associate professor of cinema arts in the School of Creative Arts at the University of Windsor. Her new book is Making History Move, Five Principles of the Historical Film. She's also co-host of the podcast Moving Histories. Kim, good morning.
Good morning.
This year alone, there's Oppenheimer, Maestro, The Zone of Interest, Killers of the Flower Moon. All films are based on real people and events. I guess there's also The Holdovers, which is set in the past, Poor Things, An Imagined Past. Why does the Academy love this type of film so much?
I think there's two reasons. Ever since the beginning of film, there was this, film begins in Nickelodeons, sort of peep show screenings on machines, and it's considered a lower class, not even an art form, a lower class thing to do. And part of trying to make film into something with a lot more prestige was making history on film. And of course, anytime you have a medium for telling stories, it is going to be telling history, because we can't tell stories about the future so much. So we're telling stories about the past. And so there's this huge amount of money that's involved too with a historical film. Right from the beginning, you have costumes, you have these fabrics, and you're trying to recreate this past world. So I think it's always been a prestige genre. And so I think the Academy likes that. And we have the sense that we're learning something. So there's this intellectual sort of frisson to the historical film. And then I think that, within Hollywood, just the sheer amount of money you have to pull together to put on one of these films, to create the sets, to create the costumes. And then the filmmaker has to withstand the criticism, because people critique historical films in a much more, vicious way than fiction, because it feels personal to a lot of us. It can intersect how we feel, our national heritage, all these kinds of things. So I think there's all of these elements coming together to make the historical film like the most challenging to make and the most prestigious as well.
What about audiences? Do they share the same love for historical films?
I think so. I mean, I certainly do. And the box office receipts for Oppenheimer definitely tell that story. It's getting close to $1 billion now. And of course, some film like Barbie is, also incredibly beloved. But historical film, they would make historical films, and they wouldn't put up this kind of money if they weren't getting a return.
You've got a book that outlining five principles for examining historical film. Can you briefly walk us through them?
Yeah, so I spent about 10 years on the book, and I started by thinking about philosophy of history, and I was really interested in, what ideas are used for academic history to think through what history is, how do we do it better, and I wanted to apply that to film. And in doing that, I came up with these five principles, and I'm also a filmmaker, a documentary filmmaker. So I was thinking as a filmmaker, but also as a scholar, how can we analyze films? And so I think this works on both ends. The first principle is narration. So we think about what story do we choose to tell? You know, what topic have we selected? And then what narrative frame do we put it into? Is it a tragedy? Does it have a happy ending? And that will frame what the argument is. So we're taking the data of the past with real people and events, and then we're framing it through a narrative. So that's the most important choice that a filmmaker makes. And what we should be mindful when we watch a film and we think about it afterwards, we can think about, okay, well, what choice, how did that filmmaker decide to frame it? How did Christopher Nolan frame Oppenheimer's story? He could have framed it in many different ways. The second one is evidence, because that's what separates fiction from history, is that you're making a claim that these things happened.
How accurate is the historical movie?
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that people, it's a way, and I'm really interested in like how audiences engage with the film. You know, 1970s film theory thought that we were passive and we just, you know, we just sat there and it's true our metabolism dips, but we are very active. We're putting it, and we're responding to a film in a similar way to real life. I mean, we didn't evolve to watch films. So although we know that Jaws isn't going to come out and, you know, grab us, we respond emotionally. We, you know, who hasn't cried at a film, laughed, you know, so we get incredibly emotionally involved. And then another way that audiences can engage with a historical film is then they can do more research. They'll often go next stop Wikipedia if the film is interested in them at all. And you can debate like the meaning that, you know, what did they select as evidence? What story did they tell? And was that accurate? Was it right? And I think that's a way the audience can get involved, which is really what interests me most about historical films. The third is reflexivity, and this comes from film scholarship and this interest in these moments of rupture when the audience is sort of jostled out of the immersion in the story. And that's a very also important, you know, philosophy of history idea, when the reader or the audience member is reminded that this is a structure, this isn't really exactly what happened, but this
so
is
when,
a rupture.
In Oppenheimer, for example, they're going back and forth between past and present.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you have these shots of the, you know, the epic shots of the universe and a close-up shot of Oppenheimer's face. And yeah, you've got the black and white, the color and the chopped up time. It reminds me of Pulp Fiction, that you can kind of put it back together as an audience member as you're watching or afterwards. And that all it makes history messy in a way that is, I think, very useful for us to be critical watchers, because we don't just absorb it as a story. It's not going, you know, connecting one event to the next. So that's something I really love to see in historical films. I think it's a sort of an intellectual, and yet it can also be entertaining way to, you know, do history. Number four.
Yeah. And you got two more principles, foreignness, how much we know about a film, and then plurality, who's represented in a movie. But I want to pick up on that second principle you talked about, accuracy, because obviously with historical films, that's a big issue. Let's talk about one film in particular.
90 years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
That's a stirring speech from Mel Gibson as Scottish freedom fighter William Wallace in the film Braveheart. What does that film illustrate about historical films?
Yeah, so I've been loving to loathe that film since it came out in 1995, and it did win Best Picture, actually, which I find to be quite a sacrilege. So it's filled with all these problems, continuity errors, people's hair flipping parts in scenes, or William Wallace is running with a weapon and one shot cuts to the next, his hands are empty. But there's all sorts of inaccuracies in that film. In terms of art direction, he's wearing a kilt. And, you know, kilts look great in movies. Of course, filmmakers, if you were doing anything about Scotland, you've got to have a kilt. And yet,
but at that time period, they weren't wearing kilts.
No, it was like a couple hundred years later that, so because he was living in the late 18th and early 14th century, and kilts don't come along for, you know, hundreds of years later.
I've read it said that Braveheart is the most historically inaccurate film ever.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, that would be a fun list to compile. It definitely, and in terms of the plot, he has this romance with Isabella of France, and it's intimated in the film that she's pregnant with William Wallace's child at the end. And in reality, she was 7 years old when he died. So this, like, I find that so unethical for the audience to mess with the audience this way, and for the people themselves, like, these things didn't happen. So that's, and I'm, you know, not trying to play the hall monitor. And that's a lot of film theorists will get, you know, frustrated about that with historians. And I'm kind of trying to come down the middle and just talk about, you know, you can make a film. I mean, the challenge of history is that you are and should be hemmed in by facts. And that's what, to me, makes the history genre the most impressive. Because if you can do something captivating without playing fast and loose in the way Braveheart does, then, you know, that's the craft of it.
Well, you raise the question of ethics, though, in the audience. How do historical films, whether it's Braveheart or Oppenheimer, shape our perception of these very real events and people?
They really do. And so audience, there's been a lot of studies done in this, and I love that this has been studied. People will go into a historical film. They've even done a study where they gave participants historical articles and, you know, very hewn close to the known facts to read and then watch a film, like, say, you know, some sort of historical film that's done by Hollywood. And they tell them to, you know, try to hold on to the facts you read. And afterwards, it's like these films come in and sweep the slate almost clean. And what people remember and what they think was the past was what they saw in the film. So it's to me, it's a cheap out to try to say, like, well, we know it's entertainment, because it's not. It's much more than that.
The film industry has been criticized for shutting out some stories. Let's talk about another one that's nominated this year, Killers of the Flower Moon. That has been criticized by some indigenous audiences for focusing on and humanizing the white men who carried out the systematic murders of the Osage people. What impact does it have? Who's making these historical films? Whose history is told in them?
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. That's the fifth principle of plurality, is about who's on the screen, who's making the films as well. And I think that that's a very valid critique. I was kind of frustrated. I felt like they centered Killers of the Flower Moon around the least interesting characters in the story. But I do think that someone like Martin Scorsese making a film that centers Osage people, I think it is going to, you know, Molly Burkhart, who's played by Lily Gladstone, that she's favored to win Best Actress. And it's bringing a lot of attention. And I think people are going to want to see more films about Indigenous histories, and they're going to want to see them made by Indigenous filmmakers. So I think it's a good thing. Like, I watched that film, and I want to see, you know, Sterling Harjo, who made Reservation Dogs. I'd love to see him do a historical film.
Oh, yeah. And I guess that's one of the points of historical films, is they can amplify voices that have been silenced. The question of rewriting history, is that an important question for you?
Yeah, totally. It's really, really important. I think that we need to see other perspectives. We need to see stories from other points of view, histories, how they impacted other people. I find it interesting, you know, most of us are not aristocrats or kings and queens and in the 1%. And yet we don't see histories about the, you know, farmers, the lower classes, and all sorts of different kinds of people. And I think that would be really, really interesting. And I think it's really important. It's important for us to have that context and in order to situate ourselves.
We've only got a few seconds left, Kim, but I hate to put you on the spot here, Sunday, I got to ask you, do you think one of these historical films is going to take Best Picture?
Well, I'm assuming it's going to be Oppenheimer. I don't know how these politics work in Hollywood, but it's been steamrolling all the other awards. So it'd be quite the upset and quite the curious thing if Oppenheimer doesn't win.
We're all going to be sitting with our popcorn watching on Sunday to find out. Thank you, Kim. I'm sure you'll be watching it closely.
I will. Thanks so much.
Kim Nelson is an associate professor of cinema arts in the School of Creative Arts at the University of Windsor. Her new book is Making History Move, Five Principles of the Historical Film, and it is out March 15th.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.